Mayer was trying to find a graceful way to retire. Whispers about why he was trying to retire. To still them, 8 separate times he denied that he was thinking of leaving office. Once, on vacation in Florida, personally telephoning a New York Times editor to do so. But by August, every swing of the spotlight brought it closer and closer to those shadowy places in his past. There was a grand jury in Brooklyn investigating racketeering in that borough, and there were all sorts of rumors flooding City Hall about what that grand jury was learning and preparing to reveal about the man who had once been the borough's crusading district attorney. United States Senator Estes Gafavor's Senate Committee investigating organized crime was preparing to hold hearings in New York, hearings that would concentrate on the links between the city's underworld and the city's politicians, and television cameras were preparing to focus on the nervously twitching fingers of key witness Frank Costello. The time for denials was past. Now was time for flight. On the eve of a mass police department trial for bribery, more than 100 policemen resigned. So did the police commissioner and his 2 top aides. And so, as the spotlight swung at last full force on his handsome, charming face, did William O'Dwyer. Ed Flynn dropped in on Harry Truman to pass the time of day, Billo was appointed ambassador to Mexico, and on August 31, 1950, almost 18 years to the day after Tammany's most popular mayor had fled the country, Tammany's second most popular mayor crossed the border into Mexico. Impey. All during August, Moses had been in South America, drawing up a Rockefeller-financed plan of improvement for Sao Paulo, utterly unaware of the events crushing in on O'Dwyer. But O'Dwyer's resignation was to place the city in his power more completely than ever before. By law, the successor to a retiring mayor is the president of the city council. By fate, the council presidency was held in 1950 by an individual who, during the entire 45 utterly undistinguished years of his life prior to his nomination to that $25,000 per year post, had never been deemed worthy of holding any job more responsible than that of secretary at $6,500 per year to a judge named Schmuck. The nomination of this totally unknown minor Tammany ward healer to the city's second highest elective office, the position of succession to the mayoralty, had staggered, in Warren Moscow's words, even the most imaginative among political reporters. And so had the explanation of how he had obtained the nomination. At a last-minute reshuffling of the 1945 Democratic ticket, the leaders finally agreed on Lazarus Joseph for comptroller, and then realized that since O'Dwyer was Irish and from Brooklyn, while Joseph was Jewish and from the Bronx, the slate could have an ethnic and geographic balance only if its third member was an Italian from Manhattan, and were unable to think of a single Manhattan Italian official they could trust. After hours of impasse, one leader reasoned that since legal secretaryships to state Supreme Court justices carried a respectable salary for which little or no work was required, they would have been given only to the safest of Democratic workers. Pulling out a little green book, the official directory of city employees, he turned to the list of legal secretaries, ran his finger down it, looking for a name that even the dumbest voter would be able to tell was Italian, and came to Vincent R. Impellitteri. "No one knew who the hell he was," Reuben Lazarus was to recall. But, looking up Impellitteri's address, the leaders determined that he lived in Manhattan, telephoned his district leader, and were assured, "You don't have to worry about him. He's a good boy." Although attested to privately by members of Tammany's hierarchy, and by Moses, whose presence at the crucial ticket-making session, he was the only outsider there, reveals his standing with that hierarchy, this explanation seemed almost unbelievable, until one met Impellitteri. If he had a single qualification for the job, other than the length of his name and the fact that it ended in a vowel, he kept it carefully hidden during his 5-year tenure as council president. He was re-elected with O'Dwyer in 1949. "The perfect throttle bottom," Moscow called him. He voted as the mayor told him to, on matters he did not necessarily understand, and spent most of his waking hours shaking hands at public dinners, political clam bakes, and cornerstone layings too unimportant to merit the mayor's presence. Amiable but slow-witted, he was a joke among political insiders. But now, he was mayor, and the joke was on the city. Impellitteri's wits may have been slow, but he had two fast wits, ex-O'Dwyer aide Bill Donahue and a young Sharpie named Sidney S. Barron, as PR men. Impellitteri had to run in a special election in November if he wanted to hold the office he had fallen into, which meant that he had less than 10 weeks in which to create an image and a record, and his PR men quickly hit on two ways to do it. First, take advantage of the fact that no one knew him, that he was therefore not identified with any political bosses, that his opponent, Ferdinand Pecora, was backed by Tammany boss DeSapio, and that, unable to get Impellitteri the Democratic nomination, the clique in Tammany that pulled his strings had him running as an independent, and portray him as the anti-boss, anti-politician, anti-corruption candidate. One of Barron's better lines, "If Pecora is elected, Frank Costello will be your mayor, but the voice will be that of Pecora." Second, identify him with Robert Moses. The price of that identification came high, both in specifics. Moses made Impellitteri pledge publicly that if he was elected, he would not reappoint Finkelstein, and in generalities. Impellitteri privately promised Moses even more of a free hand than he had enjoyed under O'Dwyer in setting all city construction policies. But Impellitteri paid it. He got full value in return. Refusing an offer of the Republican nomination, time had dimmed at least some GOP leaders' memories of 1934, Moses gave him his endorsement. "Even I, who thought that by this time I knew Bob and the lengths to which he would go, never thought he would go that far," says Lazarus. Remonstrating, he said, "But Bob, he hasn't any capacity for the job at all." Moses' response? He laughed at that. Publicly, the coordinator declared that Impellitteri has shown extraordinary courage and independence. And, as always, a Moses endorsement made almost every front page in town. The Herald Tribune article stated, "It was not a political endorsement, Mr. Moses basing his support on his opinion that the Impellitteri administration was carrying out the city construction program as planned." Moses led Impellitteri around to officiate at openings of, and share in the credit and front page pictures for, highways and housing projects with which he had nothing to do except to affix his signature as council president to documents his aides say he often had not even bothered to read. Most observers, noting that the campaign consisted mainly of charges and countercharges of bossism and corruption, felt that the endorsement from an official characterized as independent and believed above corruption was an important factor, almost as important as the decision by newspaper headline writers to call him impy and thus give him a lovable public image in Impellitteri's victory, the first in the city's history by a candidate running on an independent line without the support of either major party. And after his election, Impellitteri continued to pay the price, eagerly. Thanks to his PR men and his physical appearance, his addiction to the blue suit and the boutonniere, combined with his iron-gray hair, deeply earnest mien, and stolidity that during the campaign was mistaken for dignity, made him the very model of a modern mayor. At the approach of a camera, his brow would furrow, his lips would purse, his jaw would jut, and his eyes would focus on whatever piece of paper happened to be handy just as intently as if he understood the words written on it. Impy had run a great race, but once in possession of the prize he had won, he proved to have not the slightest idea of what to do with it. He disclaimed any influence over the Board of Estimate, telling reporters, "All I have is 3 votes on it, you know." Mayors were always telling reporters that, but City Hall insiders soon realized, to their astonishment, that this mayor believed it. Says one of his aides, Victor F. Condello, "Impy never understood that he had any power at all." Once, Condello suggested that the mayor call the 5 borough presidents to an executive session to discuss a thorny issue. "Yeah," the mayor said, "that's a good idea." Pause. "You think they'll come?" He was too timid to confront even his own subordinates. Once, a newspaper leveled detailed charges against one. The next time they met, the mayor asked him if the charges were true. "Of course not," the appointee said firmly. Impellitteri never mentioned the matter again. He would take orders from whoever happened to be talking to him at the moment. Even his enemies had to confess that Impellitteri, personally, was a very nice man. No one could watch him, childless himself, chatting warmly with the groups of children who visited City Hall, and doubt that. The warmth of his greetings for all delegations, in fact, was beyond affectation, if occasionally a cause for snickers. Once, hearing the sound of singing from behind Impey's office door, an aide walked in to find a choir in action, and the mayor standing with them, wearing a contented, if somewhat vacant expression, humming merrily away. But he was a man simply unequal to meeting the duties that had been thrust upon him. The responsibilities he was charged with carrying out utterly bewildered him. At times, he presented an almost pathetic figure as he groped his way through the intricacies of government. Says Warren Moscow, "My God, at Board of Estimate executive sessions, he'd sit there and some problem would come up, and the poor bastard would say, 'I got no answer on this, boys. You got any ideas?'" And if no one had any, the 101st mayor of the city of New York would sit there with his gavel before him, literally wringing his hands in agitation while long minutes passed in painful silence. He was desperate for someone to turn to, almost frantically anxious to drop his enormous powers and responsibilities into someone else's hands. And the biggest hands around were those of Robert Moses. Within weeks of Impellitteri's inauguration, Lazarus was noting in his diary that "Robert Moses is actually running this town today. There's no important act Impellitteri takes or does that he doesn't consult Mr. Moses." Soon, the town's other top political insiders were saying the same thing. The consultations were held at Gracie Mansion almost every morning, with Moses dropping by at about 9 or 9:30, or even earlier. And these were private consultations. When Moses was closeted with Impellitteri in the Gracie Mansion drawing room, no one else was allowed to be present. Asked why, years later, Impey would say, "I considered those very important sessions for me in the city, and I didn't want them interrupted." Sometimes the mayor saw no one else until 11. "He would always come with a big envelope," Impellitteri would recall, and the envelope would be filled with papers Moses wanted him to sign, and invariably by the time Moses drove away in his big limousine, they would be signed. One top official says that Impellitteri never left the mansion in the morning until Moses had given him his marching orders for the day. Papers that were prepared for signature later in the day were delivered by messenger to the mayor's office at City Hall, with peremptory Moses covering notes, "There is no use boring you with figures." And the papers were invariably signed, and the marching orders were invariably obeyed. "Moses' word was law with him," Condello says. "All Impey wanted was to keep him happy. I had written a letter to several department heads. Moses got pissed off about it. I never did figure out why. And he wrote to the mayor, 'Dear Vincent, what is this all about?' And the mayor called me up and said, 'For God's sake, straighten this out with Moses.' I tried to explain to him that there was nothing for Moses to get angry about, but he didn't even want to listen to what it was. He was in a real panic. He just didn't want to do anything to irritate Moses. Moses' word was law in the city." One proof that Moses' word was law was in the appointments Impellitteri made, and in those he didn't make. Tammany kingpin Frank J. Sampson, Impellitteri's old district leader, distributed the bulk of the administration's routine patronage. But for high-level jobs in departments whose responsibilities in any way touched on Moses, Impellitteri almost invariably asked Moses for a recommendation, and should Impellitteri neglect to ask, Moses gave a recommendation anyway, submitting so many that the mayor's files were crammed with them. They were dutifully followed. By the end of Impellitteri's term, there existed within the upper echelons of the city government an extensive network of men whose first loyalty was not to that government, but to the man who ran the independent government on Randall's Island. Off Randall's Island flowed, moreover, not only recommendations, but disapprovals. Time and again, men being considered for key city posts were quietly blackballed by Moses, in most cases without their ever knowing about it, in cutting phrases. Is there any evidence that he is worth $25,000? Not heavy enough for the job. Would certainly not impress the Albany educational authorities, to whom the city looks for additional aid. That concealed the real reason for his disapproval, that they had not proven themselves sufficiently ready to swallow their pride and their independence, abandon their own theories and beliefs, and unquestionably accept his. And Moses' negative counsel was followed by Impellitteri as slavishly as his positive. Another proof was in the policies to which Impellitteri put his signature. They were Moses' policies. During the Impellitteri administration, through a secret understanding with Governor Dewey, largely engineered by Moses, the city was allowed to adopt a series of financial measures whose common denominator was the fact that they fell hardest on those least able to afford them. The city sales tax, earlier raised from 1 to 2% with Moses' backing, was now raised from 2% to 3%. The subway and bus fare, earlier raised from 5 cents to 10 cents with Moses' backing, was now raised from 10 cents to 15. By a transit authority created to bear the public's blame for the increase and thereby insulate politicians, whose creation, combined with the legislative mandate to run mass transit on a self-supporting basis, removed from the city's constitutional debt limit the $425 million in transit debt service Moses had so long wanted removed so that borrowing capacity could be freed for his own projects. And proof lay in the speeches the mayor made. The voice was the voice of Impey, but the words were the words of Moses. By the time Impellitteri was running in the Democratic primary in 1953, Moses was giving point-by-point suggestions for his major television talks. One list was headed by the suggestion that the mayor make reference to records of heads of several important departments, including, prominently, the head of the Department of Parks. Moses liked to keep the strings on his puppet short. During the summer, which he spent in Babylon, he kept the mayor convenient to hand, inviting him to vacation in the handsomely furnished shelter cottage at Fire Island State Park, just across the bay. More proof that Moses' word was law in the city was in what happened to the City Planning Commission and its master plan. When O'Dwyer retired, Jerry Finkelstein had 4 months remaining before his term expired. During those months, the young commission chairman fought for the master plan, pushing the consultants to finish the crucial rezoning proposal, issuing press releases trying to explain the value of establishing local neighborhoods as the basis for studying planning needs. But he was fighting against a master. The rezoning study, 290 pages long, profusely illustrated, crammed with detailed maps and charts, was completed in September, ready for detailed study by city officials and the public, and for public hearings leading to its adoption. But, Orton says, like dopes, we hadn't gotten enough money to publish the darn thing when we got our appropriation, and we had to go back to the Board of Estimate, with a new mayor sitting at its head. Trying to force Impellitteri's hand before the election, Finkelstein wrote the mayor in October appealing for his support. There was no reply, and when, after he had written again, an answer did come, it came in the words of Moses. A letter over Impellitteri's signature said that the mayor would have no objection to having the $9,750 printing item brought up for consideration at the next board meeting, if copies were sent to him and other members of the board immediately to give them time to study them. Well, of course we couldn't do that, Orton was to recall. We didn't have copies. It was to make copies that we were asking for the money. Finkelstein, in a hospital suffering from exhaustion, attempted to take his case to the public by issuing a release stating that the failure to appropriate $9,750 for printing the report would mean that the $325,000 already spent preparing it would be completely wasted. Orton appeared before the board in executive session to press the point. But when Orton finished, Moses got up and, Orton recalls, argued that the whole thing was a bunch of tripe, nonsense, what a lousy job it was, waste of money, all the things that lawyers say, incompetent, irrelevant. And the board, with Impellitteri nodding placidly at its head, when Finkelstein had sent the mayor a copy of the local neighborhood's proposal, he had sent it to Moses for an explanation, and Moses had sent it back with a note stating, "Dear Vince, here's the answer. The attached is a silly idea." Refused to vote the additional funds, and the report for which Finkelstein had fought so hard had still not been seen by anyone outside the commission when, while still in the hospital, his term ran out on December 31st. At Moses' request, Impellitteri moved into Finkelstein's job and into the office Finkelstein had so optimistically redecorated only a year before. Colonel John J. Bennett, who was shortly to be in the process of organizing, with Moses' approval, a Title I project that was to reap its organizers' enormous profits. Orton hoped against hope that the new chairman, who certainly had a distinguished career resume, former state attorney general, Democratic candidate for governor, judge, noted attorney, would carry out the duties of his job. But he saw at the very first meeting that such hopes were useless. Bennett was totally subservient to Moses. The two members of the commission who had strayed briefly from Moses' fold at the enticement of O'Dwyer and Finkelstein soon were back among the flock. Why cannot be said, but it was at about this time that Moses gave Cleveland Rogers permission to do his biography, and it was also at this time that Moses had Impey give John Rydell, chief engineer of the Board of Estimate, a hefty salary increase. Rydell and Rogers, who had supported the master plan before, now switched their votes, combining with Bennett, and the caster of the decisive fourth vote, Robert Moses, to overrule the commission's three liberals, Orton, Francis J. Blaustein, and Goodhue Livingston, and defeat all proposals to advance it. Under Bennett, the planning commission was in Moses' hands as firmly as it had been in the days when $15,000 per year Edwin Ashley Salmon wielded its gavel. Many of the eager young planners Finkelstein had brought in were forced out. Work on the master plan all but stopped. Eventually, the consultant zoning report was printed, but the four-man majority on the commission saw to it that the public hearings Finkelstein had dreamed of were never held, and that the commission never adopted the report as its own, so that it remained without official status. The $325,000 spent on the rezoning was wasted completely, but $325,000 was an almost infinitesimal item compared to the real cost to the city of the return of Moses' control of its planning commission. In his 1 year as chairman, Finkelstein had, in compromises like that at Washington Square, subtly employed the commission's inferential powers to persuade large real estate developers to sit down with local residents and work out plans that would, while allowing the developers their profits, save the fabric of the neighborhoods in which they would be built. He had moved to preserve neighborhoods from city as well as private improvements by establishing the principle that local neighborhoods must be the basis around which planning works. He had gotten the commission to work on a study of the UN area that might save the city from the enormous costs of having to expand the site if it were found too small, and that would have ensured that surrounding private development would not be haphazard, but based on some rational guidelines. He had started the commission developing playground criteria that might save the city the immense wastage of building and maintaining playgrounds that no one used. He had personally saved the city, even if accidentally, from the mid-Manhattan elevated expressway. Most important, in that 1 year, he had started the commission down the road, an astonishingly long way down the road, to the formulation of a rational plan for the development of the city as a whole. Manhattan might be largely lost, as O'Dwyer was to say, "Now the city's built up around the mistakes that were made. It's too late to tear down skyscrapers to put in things that you would have if properly planned." But there was plenty of almost empty canvas, mostly of Staten Island, the great central belt of Queens, huge expanses of Brooklyn, even bits of the Bronx, on which to draw from scratch, to ensure that the people who moved into these areas would have schools, colleges, public libraries, parks, playgrounds, and shopping areas and jobs close enough so that they would not have to waste a substantial portion of their lives getting to and from them. In all those areas of the city, the rule of reason could have been allowed to operate substantially unfettered, and Jerry Finkelstein had, by creating a master planning staff, organizing it, and assuring it of his support, inaugurated a program that would have done just that. But now Finkelstein's year was over. Robert Moses was back in control. The rule of reason was over. The rest of the city was going to be built by the law which had governed the building of the earlier parts, the law of the jungle. And proof lay in Moses' relationship with the city's legislative bodies, the city council and the board of estimate, already so effectively dominated by him through his use of the power of money. Council President Rudolph Hawley, a liberal concerned with the social implications of governmental policies, began to question some of Moses' proposals. Moses' attitude, expressed at a lunch on Randall's Island, to which Mrs. Hawley was also invited, was, she says, "Oh, little boy, sit down. Father knows best." Hawley did not believe so, but he found that most of his fellow councilmen were reluctant to challenge Moses, and that he could do little to influence them. "It was a terribly frustrating period for Rudy," Mrs. Hawley says. "He felt so strongly about things, the same things that people feel strongly about today. But then he was ahead of his time, and he couldn't get anything done." The council president has no real power. When Hawley persisted in closely questioning Moses, or more usually, since Moses himself seldom deigned to appear, Moses' deputies, during their appearances before the council, Moses adopted a simple solution. He not only refused to discuss his programs with the council himself, but would not allow his aides to discuss them. And to Hawley's frustration, the council's Tammany majority approved those programs anyway. Hawley and Wagner, busy trying to ingratiate himself with the city's liberals in preparation for his own upcoming try for the mayoralty, offered opposition on the Board of Estimate. Moses adopted the same tactics there. Bronx Borough President Lyons, raging publicly, said, "We've seen very little of Mr. Moses at board meetings, either open or executive. He does all his business at Gracie Mansion." Says Moscow, "Under Impellitteri, it was taken for granted that Moses was mayor. There was no question about it." If Impellitteri didn't know how to exercise a mayor's powers to whip board members into line, Moses did, and the board members knew it, well enough so that none of them dared with any seriousness or regularity to challenge him. During the 40 months of the Impellitteri administration, the trends Moses had caused during the last 44 months of the O'Dwyer administration, the 44 months beginning in January 1947, in which Moses exercised near absolute power over the construction of all public works, intensified. During the O'Dwyer administration, the city spent $3,102,000 on the construction of colleges, $1,169,000 on the construction of libraries, and $80,826,000 on the construction of highways. Before the war, the city's hospital situation had been desperate. $80 million was more than twice as much as the city spent on hospitals during the O'Dwyer administration. It was more even than it spent on elementary and high schools. During the Impellitteri administration, the city spent $16,176,000 on colleges, $4,118,000 on libraries, $70,314,000 on hospitals, $137,290,000 on schools, and $172,294,000 on highways. It built 88 miles of new highways, but not 1 mile of new subways. Near the end of the Impellitteri administration, more than 8 full years after the city had announced the start of a crash program to replace all non-fireproof schools, there were still 182 non-fireproof schools in use. some 38,777 elementary school pupils were failing to get a full day's schooling because lack of new construction had caused such severe overcrowding that double or triple sessions were necessary. One out of every three of the city's school children sat in classrooms that were overcrowded by any educational standard. The four free municipal colleges, City, Hunter, Brooklyn, and Queens, had a combined capacity so inadequate that a study showed that 46,000 students per year who would have gone to college had a municipal institution been available were unable to do so. Taylor had warned McGoldrick, and McGoldrick had warned Joseph, that Moses would bankrupt the city. One way in which the controllers were afraid Moses would do this was by forcing the city to issue long-term revenue bonds to pay for the negligible city share of the costs of his public works, costs which, he assured the press and public and city officials not as familiar with city finances as the controllers, were being almost entirely borne by state and federal government. Since most of these facilities were not revenue-producing, those that produced revenue he built under the auspices of his authorities, so that they, rather than the city, would get that revenue, the only method of paying the interest on those bonds was to take the money out of the city's current revenues, to include debt service in the expense budget. Thanks to the wartime curtailment on construction, and hence on new bond floatings, at the beginning of the O'Dwyer administration, the city's debt was down to $2,194,000,000, on which the annual debt service charges were $118,000,000. By 1952, annual service charges were $211,000,000, up 78% in 7 years. Another, more subtle, but in the long run more damaging way, was in draining away for new construction so much of the city's resources that it could not pay to keep up maintenance on its existing $12 billion physical plant. Not only subways, but highways fell into this category. Even Moses' own roads could not be kept up, and the cost of neglected maintenance is astonishingly high. The West Side Highway, for example, could have been kept in perfect repair during the 1950s for about $75,000 per year. Because virtually no repairing was done, by the 1960s, the cost of annual maintenance would be more than $1 million per year, and in 1974, the highway had begun literally to fall apart, a condition that would take tens of millions of dollars to repair. By the time Moses left power in 1968, the city would be utterly unable to make even a pretense of keeping its physical plant in repair. There was a skewing of expenditures away from service functions and toward public works construction. This was especially unfortunate because the nature of the city's population was changing. Each year, more of the comfortable middle class, which required a minimum of services, left the city to be replaced by families from underprivileged Puerto Rico and from underprivileged southern states, who required more services if they were to become truly part of the city and not just live within its borders as unassimilated, hostile, bitter aliens. Instead, here is what happened. Just to make the most minimal repairs on the outmoded school plants required between $15 million and $20 million per year. During the O'Dwyer administration, less than $5 million per year had been allocated for this purpose, with the result that by the end of that administration, the backlog in minimal repairs, a staggering $30 million at the beginning of that administration, had mounted to $75 million. During the Impellitteri administration, thanks largely to the real possibility of disasters in the schools, the amount for maintenance was increased, but only slightly. By the end of that administration, the backlog of minimal repairs to the city's schools was about $100 million. Bridges were painted every 3 years. Rare was the school that was painted that often. Rare was the school that was painted every 5 years. At the end of the Impellitteri administration, there were 5 schools in the city that had not been painted in 20 years. More important than what the city's own government spent on shaping its future was what the state and federal governments spent, for their resources dwarfed the city's. During the Impellitteri administration, $498 million was poured into the city for highway and housing construction by the state and federal governments. Every cent of this money was spent under Moses' command. What was built was what he wanted built. There were, for example, 24 huge public housing projects constructed during the impellitteri era by the City Housing Authority, whose members and staff were subservient to him. Not a brick of one of those housing projects was laid without his approval. 11 huge superhighways were begun during this era. Not a mile was laid out without his express okay. The public never knew the extent of Moses' influence. One can search through the daily issues of the city's 9 remaining daily newspapers, issues crammed day after day with inside dope on City Hall, without finding a single accurate analysis of that influence. There were, for example, hundreds of stories about the housing authority's construction plans and overall policies. But because he had no direct connection with the authority, in all these stories there is hardly a mention of Robert Moses, the man whose approval was needed for every plan and who personally set most of its policies and approved the others. The 40 months that Vincent R. Impellitteri sat in the mayor's chair were a crucial 40 months for the city. It was during them that, with the exception of those on Staten Island, the city's last vast open spaces disappeared. New York filled up, assumed a new shape, the shape Moses dictated. And Moses' 40 months of absolute power enabled him to shape the city for far longer than 40 months. The appointments Impellitteri made at his recommendation would extend his influence for years after Impellitteri was no longer mayor. Protected in general by civil service, the appointees would remain in their key, sensitive posts as new mayors sat in City Hall, knowing that mayors come and go, but that Moses remained, and that, therefore, in conflicts between Moses and a mayor, it was in their interest to give their loyalty to the former. There was, moreover, the momentum effect. Qualified administrators were scarce. Mayors were constantly engaged in a search for men with real experience in handling large-scale problems. The only way to get experience was to handle such problems, and since it was Moses' men who had been placed in positions to handle them, it was Moses' men, and sometimes only Moses' men, who were qualified. More important than the men he installed, of course, were the stakes he drove. Once you get that first stake driven for a project, he had learned, no one would be able to stop it. During those 40 months of Impey, he drove a lot of stakes. He selected the routes for a dozen expressways, had thousands of families evicted from them and demolished their residences. What public official, even if he did not like the route of one of the expressways, even if he did not want any expressway built in the area at all, could thereafter say it would not be constructed, that the evictions made and money spent had been made and spent for no purpose? He selected the sites and evicted the tenants from a dozen Title I projects. What public official could then cancel a project and simply say that the blocks of debris would remain untouched? No political observer was in any doubt why Impellitteri was defeated by a resounding 2-1 majority in the Democratic primary when he ran against Robert F. Wagner Jr. in 1953. Wagner did not merely have one issue. He had all of them: the rent, tax, and fare increases to which Impellitteri had been a party, plus continued overcrowding in the schools, says Warren Moscow, at the time Wagner's borough works commissioner. With the exception of the rent increase, the policies that led to Impellitteri's defeat were Moses' policies. But the people couldn't strike back against Moses, even if they had wanted to, which they didn't, since they didn't know that he was responsible for those policies. His state positions and his authority chairmanships put him beyond their reach. The result of Moses' policies was, for Impellitteri, defeat. The result of Moses' policies was, for Moses, more power. To a man to whom power is all important, other men are judged by how much they give to him. So it was with Robert Moses and Vincent R. Impellitteri. Moses' final evaluation of the bumbling little man who had presented such a pathetic figure in his high office? He was a good mayor. To a man to whom power is all important, other men matter only as long as they possess power. So it was with Robert Moses and Vincent R. Impellitteri. Years after his retirement, the one-time mayor would sit for an interview in the law offices where he was kept, with little work to do, as window dressing by a much younger man who liked window dressing around him, Joseph F. Carlino, the best-tailored speaker in the history of the New York State Assembly. The one-time mayor was almost pathetically glad to have someone to talk to about his days as mayor, and he was very glad indeed to talk about Bob Moses, once he had taken care to make sure the interviewer understood that it had always been he, not Moses, who had given the orders during the old days. He would get to Gracie Mansion early in the morning. He had what he called an agenda. Pause. And sometimes I had an agenda. Let me put it this way. I think Mr. Moses will go down in history as the most brilliant, the most imaginative, and certainly the most, certainly a man whose integrity is always beyond question. The leading public figure in America, not only in New York City, but in America. He spent billions of dollars of public funds without anyone ever putting a question mark. He went on for some time reminiscing about how close he and Moses had been. Then, however, he was asked when he had last seen Moses, and the sincere, friendly face turned sad as he tried, in vain, to recall the last time he had seen the big, charming, brilliant man who had once been so friendly to him. "I haven't seen him recently," he said at last. Wagner. On those unforgettable evenings so long ago, on which Al Smith's Court of Appeals had convened over cracked clams and cold beer, Moses, singing at the piano with the governor's big arm around his shoulders while Jimmy Walker played, had often seen, sitting silent and wide-eyed in that room filled with loud, boisterous men, as close to his father as he could get, a shy little boy. For Robert Ferdinand Wagner Sr., who had been the governor's roommate when they had both been young legislators in Albany, made a point, ever since young Robert's mother had died when he was 9, of taking the boy with him whenever he could. Moses had given the senator's son a helpful boost onto the first rung of the political ladder. In his first race for political office, for an assembly seat from his father's old Yorkville district in 1937, he had enabled him to promise a swimming pool for John J. Park on 78th Street. "Bob Moses was very nice to me," he would recall. "He was going to build it anyway, I'm sure, but he gave me an opportunity to tell my constituents that I had gotten it there, and I was always very grateful to him for that." In his climb up the ladder, however, young Wagner, while strikingly regular in all other respects, had displayed what Moses regarded as an infatuation, especially disappointing in one from so sturdy a background, with the radical notion of city planning. As chairman of the City Planning Commission, he had pushed the master plan, and had even supported Stanley Isaacs' silly notion that the plan should preserve and protect the city's neighborhoods. Moses' relationship with the younger man had worsened during his Manhattan borough presidency, in part, perhaps, because Wagner, aware, as was his patron, Carmine DiSapio, of the importance of contractors in the new political scheme of things, insisted on using his own, not Moses. Once, in fact, after Wagner Sr. was safely in retirement, Moses had written a letter, distributed as usual to a mailing list of hundreds, calling Wagner Jr. a bubblehead. Wagner, for his part, kept his own counsel. Wagner always kept his own counsel. But while he never attacked Moses directly, publicly or privately, "Wagner never makes derogatory remarks about people," Lutsky says. "Nobody ever heard him say a bad word about anybody. Maybe he learned that from his father." He left with intimates such as Lutsky the impression that he didn't like Moses. During his campaign for the Democratic nomination for mayor, in which, of course, he was opposing the man Moses was supporting, and in the course of wooing the good government groups embraced by DiSapio, who had hand-picked him for the job and was directing his campaign, he led them to believe that he would curb the coordinator's power. And after his election, he had brave words to the same effect. "I'm not going to let Moses come over to Gracie Mansion and give me my marching orders like he did Impey," he told Warren Moscow, whom he had drafted from the Times to be a mayoral assistant. Shortly after his election, a source close to the mayor-elect was leaking to reporters the information that Robert Moses will continue to serve in the Wagner City administration, but his powers are likely to be severely restricted, probably to those of park commissioner. Another leak soon followed, however. There was no longer any thought of removing Moses as coordinator. The good government strategists thereupon decided to try to hold the line on the sole remaining post to which he needed reappointment at Wagner's inauguration, his planning commission membership, which expired on December 31, 1953. The site of battle seemed choice. There were stronger arguments against his holding the planning commission post than the other two. As park commissioner and construction coordinator, he proposed public works projects, and the charter had surely never intended the proposer of projects to sit on the body which passed on their merits. Moreover, the mayor-elect, as a former commission chairman himself, should be able to understand the logic of such arguments. At first, Wagner did in fact seem to understand that logic. Meeting with the reformers before his inauguration, he told them he understood their views and agreed with them. The reformers left the interview believing that there would be only two jobs waiting for Moses. On inauguration day, their efforts seemed for a while to have been crowned with victory. As they sat among the hundreds of spectators crowded into the city council chamber at City Hall, watching the new mayor summon his appointees forward one after another, administer their oath of office and hand them their official oath blanks, which he had signed before the ceremonies, they saw him call up Robert Moses, swear him in as park commissioner and construction coordinator, and then, with Moses still standing beside him, waiting expectantly for the third oath and blank, beckon the next appointee forward. Watching Moses' face pale, the swarthy skin turning almost white, and then seeing the telltale reddish, almost purple flush rising out of his collar up along his neck, they whispered happily, in some cases gloatingly, among themselves. As each commissioner was sworn in, he walked out of the council chamber and into an adjoining room, where he was supposed to leave the oath blank as proof, required under the city's administrative code, that he had sworn the required oath of loyalty to the Constitution, and where he was supposed to sign the city's massive, gray-bound oath book, the official record of appointments, which was resting on a small table in front of Lutsky and an aide, Philip Shumsky. City appointments are not official until certificates of appointment are issued, but in practice they become official as soon as both the mayor's signature and that of the appointee are on the oath blank and the appointee's is in the oath book. As Lutsky and Shumsky recall it, Moses stalked in and demanded, "How about city planning?" Lutsky, who knew the mayor had decided not to make the third appointment, shrugged his shoulders as if he knew nothing, saying, "These are the only titles on the list. I just do as I'm instructed." Without another word, the two men recall, Moses stalked into the mayor's private office, to which Wagner had repaired alone before the official reception that was to follow. Neither Moses nor Wagner, the only two persons present, will discuss the confrontation in detail. But Moses was to tell aides, and Wagner, asked about the confrontation many years later, was, with an extremely pained expression, to indirectly confirm Moses' account, that he had put it to the mayor straight. Either he got the third job, or he'd quit the other two. On the spot. He'd march right outside and tell the press. As the aides related, Wagner tried frantically to stall, saying that there must have been some oversight, that some clerk must have forgotten to fill out the appointment blank, that there was nothing for Moses to worry about, that he'd see to it in a few days. Returning to the room where Shumsky and Lutsky were sitting, Moses snatched an unused blank off a sheaf Shumsky had placed on the table in case some appointee lost a blank and needed another. Sitting down at a typewriter that had been placed on another small table nearby, he typed in the date, his name, in the space marked length of term, 8 years, and, in the space marked position, Member, City Planning Commission. Then, carrying the blank, he stalked out of the room and back into the mayor's private office, and, without a word, according to his aide's recollection of the story, laid the paper on Wagner's desk. Without a word, Wagner pulled the paper toward himself and signed it. And, relates Warren Moscow, Moses increased the dimensions of his victory by relating the story of the hand-typed oath to only 50 or so of his most intimate friends, all in city government. 4 days later, there was another victory, quieter but more significant. Because the powers of the city construction coordinator had never been spelled out by law, they were what each mayor chose to make them. Reappointment to that post by Wagner did not mean much to Moses, unless he could obtain from Wagner what he had obtained from O'Dwyer and Impellitteri, authority to represent the city in negotiations with state and federal governments. On January 5th, he wrote Wagner asking if the mayor wanted him to do so. Certainly, the mayor wrote back. Moscow got a very close view indeed of Moses' next victory. Abrasive but clever, the former newspaper man decided, even before Wagner's inauguration, to create for the incoming administration some of the atmosphere of the first 100 days. You know, action. In no field was that commodity needed more than housing. The city's crisis was entering its 9th year. I asked Wagner if we had a housing program, if anyone had been assigned to do a housing program, and he said no, and I said, would you like me to take it on? And he said, okay, but make sure you keep in touch with Moses. That stricture should have been a warning, but Moscow was as short on an understanding of people as he was long on an understanding of public relations. In 2 or 3 work-crammed weeks during December 1953, he drew up the program for state-assisted middle-income housing that would, with only minor changes, later be named Mitchell Lama, after the 2 legislators who would be permitted to introduce it in Albany. He discussed it not only with Cruz and other Moses men on the housing authority, but with Moses, who said he liked it. He said, good, that'll bring the union treasuries in. But then, shortly after the inauguration, Moscow, in a secret memo, presented it to the Board of Estimate himself, instead of letting Moses do it. Moses blew his top, Moscow recalls. He wrote a memo to the mayor, one of those mimeographed things that goes around to 205 people, pretty much denouncing me, and denouncing the program that he had privately told Moscow he liked. At the same time as the denunciations were flying, however, Spargo and Liebold kept telling Moscow to ignore them. They kept coming to me and saying, here Moscow would whisper to show how the 2 Moses men talked, don't answer him. Don't blow your top. It's going to be all right. He's not really angry at you. Moscow was understandably puzzled until he figured out that he was just a substitute target. Their boss, he realized, was angry at Wagner for what he thought was the mayor's authorization to Moscow to interfere with his control of housing. But, not wanting to alienate a mayor who had otherwise proved so agreeable, had decided to make his views known to him by attacking one of his assistants instead. And the strategy worked. Despite Wagner's previously professed enthusiasm for the proposal, the mayor allowed it to languish in the Board of Estimate. Then, 3 weeks later, Moses dropped in on a board executive session. He presented his own housing program. It bore an amazing resemblance to Moscow's, except that it was now identified with Moses instead. Wagner quickly obtained the board approval that allowed it to be sent to Albany. On February 23, 1954, a black-tie dinner in the grand ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria brought to a climax the year-long celebration of New York's 300th anniversary. The principal speakers were the mayor and Robert Moses. And Moses, in his speech, went out of his way to praise my friend, Bob Wagner. Moses' relationship with Wagner would not always be so friendly. He was still a frequent early morning visitor at Gracie Mansion, and he still arrived with the large manila envelope filled with documents, but now he often went away without the mayor's signature on them, One observer reported, "He has been heard to say that he looks back with particular wistfulness upon the term of William O'Dwyer, having found him to be a mayor who would sign almost anything placed before him on the breakfast table, provided that it was accompanied by a reasonably persuasive argument. Wagner is more likely to say, 'Splendid, Bob, splendid. Before I sign this, though, let me take it along to the office and think the thing over.'" The Port Authority found city approval of its projects obtainable again, more easily obtainable, in fact, than ever before. During Wagner's entire 12 years in office, its power grew. As for the Housing Authority, Moscow's conversations with crews and authority staffers had opened his eyes to the completeness, hitherto unguessed at, keen though those eyes were, of Moses' control of a body to which he ostensibly had no direct relationship. Theoretically, he had no connection with public housing except in his capacity as construction coordinator, which gave him the overall right to stick his nose into anything, Moscow says. But Christ, Cruz wouldn't go to the bathroom unless he asked Moses first. Wagner became a little worried about the authority, Moscow says, presumably about the possibility that its activities would result in a full-scale scandal which would reflect on his administration, and seriously considered ousting Cruz. Unlike the other four members of the board, who were appointed for fixed 5-year terms, Housing Authority chairmen served at the mayor's pleasure, a possibility which delighted liberals, who felt Cruz was handicapped by an inability to stand up to Moses when property rights interfere with human rights. But Moses pressed the buttons, and the calls that no mayor could refuse to take, flooded in. "I want to publicly thank Commissioner Moses, Thomas Shanahan, David Rockefeller, and others who said a good word for me," said Cruz, as he was sworn in at a ceremony attended by Moses and Big Bag Man Jim Farley. When newspaper photographers sought to pose him with the mayor, Cruz asked Moses to get in the picture too. Wagner told Deputy Mayor Paul O'Keefe, "Well, I made my deal. I'm putting my man in to keep an eye on things." The mayor created a new executive directorship over the authority's staff and appointed to it Joseph P. McMurray, his father's former administrative assistant. But McMurray turned out to be more friendly to Tom Shanahan than to the mayor. During 1954, Wagner's worries increased, and by the spring of 1955, he decided that more direct action was necessary. McMurray was replaced by Moscow, quite simply to take control of the assigning of architects away from Shanahan, and Cruz was called in for a very confidential chat. The former $9,000 per year Park Department clerk loved his $22,500 per year chairmanship. He was informed that if he wanted to keep it, some small adjustments in his loyalties would be necessary. Cruz had a switch, Moscow would say privately years later, with a faint, mocking smile. He, of course, had grown up in the Park Department and was very close to Moses. He was Moses' protege. But Cruz made his divorce. Thereafter, in matters of controversy, Cruz took his views from the mayor. All this maneuvering went on backstage, without any direct confrontation between Moses and the mayor. It, and other subtle tests of will and strength between the two men, led, however, to constant tension between them, as did more trivial incidents. Bob Wagner was no less jealous of his prerogatives than any other mayor, Paul R. Scrivane says, and Moses didn't come to Bob enough and consult him. Wagner occasionally attempted to assert his authority over his commissioner by asking him to come down to City Hall. Generally, Moses made some excuse, but occasionally Wagner insisted, and Moses, needing something from the mayor, had no choice but to go. When he was forced to make the trip, however, he invariably disciplined Wagner by showing up late. At receptions at Gracie Mansion, Wagner, moving quietly from one guest to another, "He does a lot of his work in whispers at parties," one observer wrote, was remarkably inconspicuous. When Moses entered the room, generally trailed by enough aides to make his entrance conspicuous, women patted their hair and made sure it was in place, and discreetly took out pocket mirrors to check their lipstick, and men watched him out of the corners of their eyes. His physical presence and vitality as he stood, head thrown back, teeth gleaming in his dark face, handsome, charming, physically overpowering his listeners, perhaps with a big arm around the shoulders of one, recounting fascinating anecdotes about Smith or Roosevelt or LaGuardia, made him, as always, the focal point of the room. And sometimes Wagner, seeing his guest's attention slipping away from him just a bit, could be observed watching the coordinator from a